Next up on This Week in Law, as we record, the Apple versus Samsung trial is going on, and we're going to look at some of the great coverage coming out of that trial with The Verge's Nilay Patel and Matt McCary. Sally Wentworth is with us from the Internet Society. She's going to walk us through the thicket that is Wicket next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 173, recorded August 3rd, 2012. Wicket real good. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TWiL. Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. We've got an amazing panel here with us today. I'm so excited to bring back to the show Nilay Patel from The Verge. Hello, Nilay.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Great to see you.
Yeah, it's always fun to be on the show.
Thanks so much. it's great to have two of the legal powerhouses from The Verge on the show with us today. We've got Matt McCary coming back. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Denise. How are you doing?
Doing great. Good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt, is that a 20th anniversary Macintosh behind you?
You know it.
You are such a huge nerd. I love you, man. Yep. That's awesome.
It is indeed. And joining us from the Internet Society is Sally Wentworth. Hello, Sally.
Hello. Great to be here.
Great to have you on. Now, you're in D.C., correct?
Well, sometimes, but this week I'm coming to you from the Internet Engineering Task Force in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, lovely. Very nice video we're getting from you there in Vancouver, so that's awesome. All right, well, I want to start out talking about something in progress. Even as we speak, The Verge is covering it live with their on-the-site reporter, Brian Bishop, and that is the trial of Apple and Samsung ensuing right now in federal court. We're on, what is this, our second day of actually having witnesses take the stand in the trial. There have been a lot of fireworks. This morning, we're hearing an awful lot about Apple's advertising strategy for the iPhone and iPad. Nilay, why are they leading with that out of the gate, do you think?
You know, what's interesting about the Samsung case in particular, you know, Apple's suing everybody, or is in litigation with everybody. But with Samsung in particular, they're pursuing a trade dress claim and saying consumers are confused about who makes the Samsung's products, whether they're actually Apple products. And that the claims are, they're related to the aesthetic design of the phone. There's some design patents in the mix. You know, Samsung calls it, you know, Samsung refers to Apple's strategy as the black rectangle problem. You know, you can't patent a black rectangle. But what they're, you know, they've got Phil Schiller on the stand, Apple's head of marketing. And what he's talking about is how much money and time Apple invested into creating the consumer perception of the iPhone and the iPad. And Apple's entire strategy here is to say, you know, we invested all these resources into creating what consumers now love about the iPhone and the iPad. And Samsung showed up and they're free riding by copying most of what we did, confusing consumers about the provenance of Samsung's products and whether or not they're just as good as Apple's products by copying the aesthetic elements. And that confusion, you know, gives rise to a trade dress claim. That's really interesting, you know, because what they're doing with all the other stuff, all, you know, against Motorola, what they try to do, against HTC, what they're doing, they're all very technical, like system level software patents that really speak to Android itself. And with Samsung, the difference is that they're going after Samsung copied our products directly. That the Galaxy S looks just like the iPhone, and that's the problem. It's not as much of the wonky patent law stuff as is going on in the other cases. So I think, you know, literally this second, Samsung is cross-examining Phil Schiller, and they're talking about whether Apple actually does stuff first or whether they market it better. And it's funny because I think Schiller is going to kind of eat them alive here. Because it doesn't matter if they were first. What his whole point is that they spend so much money on marketing, creating a consumer perception that Samsung can't illegally free ride on it.
Got it. Well, that makes a lot more sense now. Matt, you're obviously closely following the trial too. What do you think about how this is all coming out of the gate?
Yeah, I agree with Neely. It's really a different situation for the Samsung trial, and it's because the story, and we did a piece, Neely and I, before the trial started, where it's real important that both of these sides have this narrative where they discuss. Apple's is clear, like Neely said, it's about, you know, it really isn't so much that they don't have to convince the jury that they were the absolute first tablet because they weren't, but they could focus on this particular look, the slate look, and they got the story that is, you know, we innovated here, we created this unique design. Samsung came in and followed and copied it, and we've heard Apple talk about their, you know, we don't want to be the designer for the rest of the world. That's kind of their story during the whole trial, and it'll be coming up, and that's what kind of the groundwork that Shiller just laid for them, without getting into the technical aspects of the patents at all. And then Samsung's kind of rebuttal story, unfortunately, they don't really have a very good one now, but their story going into it was, you know, we're not copying. Here's what we did. Here's how we innovated. And we've been doing this for 20-some years in this particular industry. It was cell phones and smartphones, and we had our own thing going. The problem with that is, as we've seen lately, that their story's been weakened a little bit because of some of the stuff they haven't been able to bring into the case with regard to evidence of that. That's a bit of a problem for them. And it's also a problem for them because they have to actually look at these products side by side and convince a jury that it's just us doing our thing. And they have all these internal documents that Samsung has been produced in the case and indicate Samsung was really concerned. Their number one focus in this area was beating Apple. And it's hard to get around that without their. So what I guess I'm saying is their narrative doesn't naturally kind of, it's not intuitive. It doesn't necessarily, it's trickier. It sounds like an afterthought more than an actual, something that happened during the industry as you were developing your products, and that's not necessarily a good thing for if you want to convince a jury. At least it's not.
Yeah, and the afterthought thing is that's why they can't get this evidence in. It's I mean it kind of was an afterthought, right? Oh, here's our narrative, and we need to get this evidence in to you know beef up our narrative to tell the story. And the judge is like, it's too late. You know, you didn't do this during any of the injunction hearings. You've had over a year to present your evidence, and you can't present it at this time so that Apple can rebut it. You know, what's also interesting, and I think kind of a problem for Samsung is they've got to keep the case either way up high at Apple can't patent a black rectangle, or way down in the weeds of, well, Apple has a patent on this black rectangle, not our black rectangle, and get really into the minutiae of you know, what these patents cover, what is appropriate for a patent to cover. And if they're anywhere in between, you know, anywhere where it's like, you know, the jury begins to believe Apple can patent a black rectangle and Samsung's products are probably within the scope of that, that's bad, right? So they've got to make a choice. I don't think they can tell both stories, you know, which is, you know, if you map it to patent law, that the Apple can't patent a black rectangle is invalidity and they can't patent our black rectangles, non-infringement, right? I don't think they can tell both stories to the jury. And anywhere in the middle, and I think it's a pretty broad middle, Apple comes out as the winner, I think. Because it's such a – because if you hold the phone side by side, it's such a bad comparison for Samsung. Even if they arrive there independently, if Apple convinces the jury that they have a, you know, a valid right here that's, you know, as broad as Apple says it is, Samsung, the jury will naturally gravitate to Apple because the thing that came second looks so much like the thing that came first. And Samsung's whole, all this stuff about the F700 to me is just nonsense. It's ludicrous. So this is the evidence they can't get in. It's evidence they were developing this phone called the F700 before the iPhone came out. And the F700 is a piece of crap. I mean, I don't know why Samsung wants to spend so much time talking about how they developed this phone that was a piece of junk, because it kind of looked like the iPhone. What they should talk about is how they were searching to make a smartphone with a full touchscreen, not a feature phone that was like four times as thick as the first iPhone, had a slide-out keyboard, and failed in the marketplace. It came out, I was saying this yesterday in our podcast, the phone that Samsung wants to rely on, that they've been arguing with the judge about the ability to talk about, the evidence that's been excluded, came out in the United States as a feature phone in Verizon called the Samsung Glide, spelled with a Y. And that's like just immediate evidence that this was a forgettable piece of junk. Like if you don't have like enough self-respect to name your phone with an English word and you resort to spelling Glide with a Y, that should be like immediately trigger, like we shouldn't predicate our defense of this $1 billion trial on getting the evidence of this phone into play. And I think Samsung needs to find a better narrative, one that I think keeps them way at the top of you can't have a black rectangle.
It's pretty interesting procedurally that Judge Koh got so angry about releasing that evidence to the media once it was excluded from trial. This is not a sealed courtroom as far as, you know, the information. Yeah, exactly. So it's not like it wasn't in the public record that they were seeking to get this information in and that it was excluded. You know, anybody could have gone to the court filings.
Yeah, and they did. Mm-hmm. I guess her issue was with it was she was just really tired of talking about it, and she saw what they did as a little whiny, and I think mm-hmm. she had a little bit of a problem. She looked at and I'm going to call it a press release because that's what it was. It references, you know, jury like three times. Then I mean it's not. I don't think there's any way she would have got away with sanctioning him, at least not seriously. Not what Apple wanted. Apple wanted basically a victory out of it. Right. So that's insane. That's not going to happen. But she could have done something, I guess. She could have put a gag order on him. I don't know. But which wouldn't really run with how she's been dealing with this case. It's meant to be public. I think she was just really irritated with them continuously bringing this up and literally begging the court over and over again to try to get this evidence in, and then going behind her back, so to speak, and whining to the press about it. I think it was a bad tactic. It didn't, whether or not they get sanctioned, I mean, they're walking on thin ice with her right now, and that's never where you want to be in the middle of a trial. So it was a bad tactic. It wasn't illegal. It wasn't unethical. It was just bad. Bad choice.
The other thing that has been entertaining me is Samsung's effort to introduce as evidence of prior art things that aren't actual inventions but are simply examples from science fiction narratives past, such as tablets occurring in 2001, A Space Odyssey. I don't know. I mean, I think I have to side with the judge on that one, that if you're going to talk about prior art, it should be something that's not just fictional. What do you think, Mili?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Samsung's, they're playing to the media, right? And they're playing to this enormous base of Android fans who are following this trial. I mean, you know, this trial, there's an enormous amount of interest in it. And Samsung's arguments, if you don't think about the legal interpretation of them, their arguments are great. You know, it's, look at this phone. We were working on it before the iPhone. Everything's fine. This is the industry. It's competition. And I think Samsung, you know, they're doing a good job of feeding that. And it's like Matt said, it was a bad tactic. I mean, I don't think you want to piss off the judge, but it was well done by Samsung in terms of changing the media narrative. You know, this evidence is excluded. If we'd gotten it in, we would have won the case. And the media ran, you know, the media printed that. You know, that's useful for Samsung in that way. Can I just say right now, there's something that happened live in the case. I'm watching Brian's update. Samsung is now trying. They've got Phil Schiller on the stand. They're showing him different Samsung phones to compare them to the iPhone to show how different they are to the jury. They're trying to get Schiller to say this phone is different than the iPhone. And they just tried that. They make so many phones, and there are so many Samsung phones at issue in the trial that the Samsung attorney just handed him a phone and didn't know which Samsung phone it was.
Oh, dear.
And Phil Schiller is like, yeah, you make so many phones, they all look like the iPhone. They're confusing.
Oh, wow.
So that's happening. Like, this is
The OJ trial. The glove, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's like, look at the Infuse 4G and tell me if it has buttons on the bottom. And Schiller is like, this isn't the Infuse 4G.
Well, good thing he knows his phone.
Yeah. That's actually maybe the one, I think, and Matt and I have talked about this, the biggest danger for Apple in this trial is they didn't focus on the Galaxy S. You know, here's our one single phone that's infringing. Or they didn't focus on two phones or whatever it is. They focused on 25 phones. And they've got to prove a litany of complaint of claims against each and every one of those phones. So they've got the jury has a lot of work to do. And, you know, Apple has been trying to break them into what they're calling representative groups of phones. So all of the Galaxy phones, all of these other phones. The judge hasn't really talked about that yet. I mean, they're still in the opening kind of gambit phase of this. But that's, I think, Apple's biggest problem and biggest danger area with the jury is simply boring them to tears with all of these claims against all of these phones, because it's a lot to sort through. I think, Matt, you called it unimaginable, the logistical challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've got their IP down to a fairly reasonable level. But, yeah, they have the burden on all those phones. And unless they can group them, and some tells me they'll be able to figure out a way somehow. Just depends on what the judge lets them get away with. But that brings up another issue, because Samsung's, I think, kind of went into this case like most defendants do when they're getting hit with patent cases, or trademark and copyright, but any IP really, is you try to confuse and complicate the matter as a defendant, because you don't have the burden of proof for infringement. So you're in there trying to muddy the waters. And I think they went into the case until the last minute kind of with that as their narrative. And that doesn't work, I think, with some of this, like the trade dress. It doesn't work with some of these design patents, because they're basic and they're pretty simple to understand. And I think that they switched up and they've gotten now to this point where they said, oh, we really need to kind of go the simpler route and convince the jury that, hey, we're just competing and here's why and here's how. And they're kind of stuck now. And I think Neil's right. They're stuck in the middle. And they're going to try to – I think they're going to end up kind of bouncing back and forth between those two narratives. And I think Apple's been pretty consistent with their narrative from day one with their complaint. And it hasn't changed any, and it's easier, except for those 25 phones. It's a lot easier to understand. So,
all right. Well, we've been talking about this on the level of the trial that is in progress right now, and of course, there's the trade dress claim. But mostly, this is all about patents. And what I'd like to do now is move back, you know, to sort of the 10,000 foot level and talk about our patent system. And I think we've got something to jibe with this conversation. So we'll move on to a discussion of Gina Smith. Of course, she's a friend of Twit and has an article in Computer World about the patent system and whether it can be saved. And it's a lengthy, in-depth piece, and she interviews a whole bunch of folks, including Pam Samuelson from the EFF. And just wondering if thank you there. I heard from the studio as to why we didn't get that. We will go ahead and talk about what Gina says here. And I'm coming out of her article with a whole bunch of pessimism that I think I went into it with about whether the current patent system is capable of being saved. And I know you have some thoughts on this, Matt.
Yeah, I might. I'm trying to kill my career here, but as a patent attorney. I don't think there's anybody except for the most naive and fake of patent attorneys that would actually say the system isn't flawed or doesn't have some room for improvement in specific areas, especially. I think, Neil has talked about this. I don't think I've really talked about this part with Neil before, but he had a statement he made about copyright law that I think is unique, because under copyright law, I think Neil believes, and I think a lot of people believe, that you can identify a problem kind of the modern age, digital age, and what the problem is, trying to shoehorn that into the current copyright laws and how they've been tweaked to try to adapt, and the problem that comes from that. The problem with the patent system is it's a lot of little things, and I have not, no matter how much I've thought about it, I have not been able to pinpoint this is a solution or even this is the problem. And I know a lot of people point out various things that they think are wrong, like software patents. But the problem with that is I don't think anybody's really identifying the problem by saying, you know, software patents are a problem. Because I don't know what that means, and I don't think most people know what that means. For instance, what is a software patent? But I think the place to start is to kind of understand what these individual industries, like maybe the tech industry, which you'd have to throw in hardware and software patents, whether or not some of these industries needs a different variant of the system. Maybe not completely different, but has certain things that change or certain focuses in the law that, like you do with plant patents or even some pharmaceutical type things. I mean, you have different applications of statutes and things that might actually affect the life of patents, the ability to enforce them, how they're enforced, and issues like that. So I think maybe Neeli has a better grasp of what the problem is, but I just see a lot of little problems. And I think some of them are wrongly identified. I think some are maybe easy fixes, but a lot of them are just kind of out there. And I think people see the results of the problem, but they don't really know exactly what it is that's causing it.
Yeah, you know, I think that the main thing with the patent system and the biggest problem with everyone who talks about fixing it is that it's based on a series of abstractions, right? And the abstractions don't line up to any reality that somebody who's interested in, technology, sees or experiences. So you've got, let's say something called a software patent exists, and we all can agree on what it is, hypothetically. A software patent is an abstraction. It's a description of a code that is itself an implementation of an algorithm. And so the abstraction from this is our idea, an algorithm for compressing video, and we've invested a lot into this idea, is now abstracted into a series of patent claims in a series of applications that kind of have nothing to do with the actual algorithm for compressing video and how it works and what it should be worth to anyone. And that, I think that disconnection between what the patent is and what the technology is getting worse and worse and worse. Because everyone's realizing that the patents themselves are really valuable, while the technologies themselves might not be as valuable. And I think that's as broad of a description of a problem as you can have. Like, I don't know how to solve that problem. But I can say that this is the thing that most people are mad about. They're mad about a system that right now incentivizes arguing about abstractions, arguing about paperwork, arguing about claims that don't really describe how a technology works. You know, a system for manipulating data on a page. Like, that, what? What the hell is that? Like, of course, or, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And I think that's like, ultimately, that's what people are mad about, is the argument is so wonky and away from them. It's so isolated into a world of experts that do not speak a language that resembles English. But they're like, why is this affecting me? Why are we having a trial about patents that make no sense? I think the other big problem here is that the patent system is supposed to be an exchange, right? The public is supposed to get valuable disclosure out of these companies in exchange for granting them a monopoly on invention, on their inventions. And we're not getting any valuable disclosure from companies. I mean, nobody's policing that. Nobody's saying to Apple, well, you've got to show us how you made the scroll back, right? Because nobody wants it. Everybody can say, I can make that on my own. I look at what Apple did. I've got four engineers working here, and Samsung just made it on their own. They didn't need the valuable disclosure. So I think we need to, really think about, are we getting everything out of the system that we wanted to get? Are we incentivizing the creation and protection of valuable technology? Is the actual document of the patent, like, on the orders of magnitude more valuable than the technology itself? That makes no sense. And are we getting, as the public, are we getting the thing out of this exchange that we're supposed to get? Are we getting the valuable disclosure? And I don't think either of those things is in balance right now. And I think if you focus on changing those things, you might get somewhere. You might solve some of these little problems that Matt is identifying. But those are big changes. I mean, those are congressional level, let's reboot the patent system changes. So, if you write a story that says, can the U.S. patent system be saved? It's like, yeah, but you got to burn the village in order to save it,
Yeah, those are excellent points, all very much on a policy plane. And I'm wondering, Sally, since the Internet Society pays so much attention to policy that relates to the Internet, and so many of the patents that we've seen at issue over the last several years have involved, how people connect to or distribute material or use the Internet. Is this something that's on your radar? And what is the Internet Society's take on the patent system?
Well, I think we've I used to be in government. I was involved in some of the discussions about patent reform on a couple of occasions, and it was always interesting and important, I think, to note as was already related to internet patent issues, that when you start pulling apart the threads of the patent system, you immediately run the issues that the pharmaceutical industry has or as part of the patent industry. So it's not as easy to segregate. Anything to the extent that this whole discussion ends up, as we all get concerned about raising costs for end users, and then looking at the global impact of some of these patent disputes that the U.S. is having on developing countries on access to technology, I think that's where we start getting, quite concerned. I'm not a patent lawyer, but defer on the expertise to the others. But I do think some rationalization is probably in order, but it's a very difficult conversation to have even within the U.S. And then going beyond that globally, it's a real heavy lift, but it's one that a lot of people and we hear about in developing countries quite a bit.
Yeah, it's tough. Look, Europe technically, and I mean really technically, doesn't allow software patents, but they do. And the problem with that is because it's really hard to isolate software and hardware in reality, especially when you're talking about defining things in a patent claim with words that you can be very creative with, you can manipulate. So it looks like a lot like hardware, but it's doing a lot of functional things. It's really software. It's tough. I know there's some suggestions that, I guess pharmaceuticals, and I'm just bringing this up, and I'm sure you've talked about Judge Posner's op-ed. That couldn't be the worst. I mean, that's the worst example. That's the worst thing for somebody to call the poster child of patents. It's one of the most controversial areas of patent law. It's highly manipulated, and it's an outlier. I mean, If we really required something to be, like inventing the wheel or some revolutionary product that requires billions of dollars worth of R&D to justify a patent, then, there would be pharmaceutical patents, and that's about it. And I mean, there weren't even pharmaceutical patents or that type of industry in existence at the time the patent system was developed. So it definitely is not the focus of our patent system. But anyway, going back to software patents and kind of that problem, some of the and I think a lot of it comes down to, like Neil said, if you really want to fix it, you got to fix what it is you allow to be protected. I'm not so sure that cutting the lifespan of a patent down to 5 years for software patents would help, because I see problems with that are probably not that interesting. But I do think that maybe there's a way to go about disclosures of things. And I agree that you don't get this trade-off that you would think you would get. The patent system is designed, okay, you submit your idea. It gets hashed out in this document, and then the public gets it free of charge basically after 20 years to do what they want with. The problem with that exchange in software patents is that patent attorneys and companies don't want to disclose all of their algorithms and all of the really harsh, really detailed, assuming they are important and they can't just be easily reverse engineered. That's especially true. You want to give away nice, broad, vague flow charts and things to describe mm-hmm. how something's done. You don't want to give all the code away. That's what copyright, you do that when you file for copyrights, right, Neil? That's something that people argue maybe that's where software patents should be, or software should be protected, is with copyright law and not with patent law.
That goes into, that's such an, that argument is an argument about differences in form, not differences in like policy or implementation, right? You're still not getting the algorithm, right? So if you give away all the code and copyright, which you wouldn't do, right? The way the copyright system works for software is you send in like a CD and you say, here are my bits, they're copyrighted. And that's like the end of it. Or you send in a representative sample and here's my code, it's copyrighted. You don't give it all away. Like, you know, Microsoft has a copyright to the Windows source code, but it's not sitting in the Library of Congress. And that's problematic, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And copyright is seemingly perpetual based on what Congress is doing with it. So that exchange just isn't there. And what you really want is the algorithm. You want the thing that makes it work. And then you can express it in different kinds of code. And, you know, code evolves and the way people program computers evolves. So you want the nut, right? You want the thing, the big piece of math that makes it all work. And I think that's really where it comes down to it is you're not supposed to be able to patent math. Maybe we should just say, you know, software is inherently mathematics, and the thing that is valuable are these algorithms, which are inherently mathematics, and screw it. You know, maybe we just shouldn't have it. But I don't know if that works. I mean, that doesn't solve, you know, like the free rider problem. It doesn't solve a lot of, people just keep the stuff locked up. They won't develop it. They won't use it. There won't be, the stuff we see, there's all these FRAND issues. Companies won't go into standards groups and share their technology to make better standards because there won't be any monetary exchange and licensing when it's all over. That leads to a cascade of additional problems. You'll see more proprietary technology. Is that good? I don't know. But every little twist of the screw changes, you know, has a butterfly effect throughout the industry. And I think the big question that we have to ask is, how do we want this to work? I mean, like, really, how do we want it to actually work for people? Not, can we just continually identify problems that seem impossible to solve?
Well, hopefully we will be able to crack that big nut at some point in the future. It's a tough one, and that's why it keeps coming up over and over and over again. But we really appreciate your guys' thoughts here today. I think they were very well informed and well advised. We're going to take a break here for a minute and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. We're here with Nilay Patel and Matt McCarry from The Verge and with Sally Wentworth from the Internet Society. And bringing us to you here today is ShareFile by Citrix. You know that businesses rely on the exchange of information between colleagues and clients every single day. Most people send them as attachments to emails. But as files have gotten bigger and security is more important than ever, that gets more and more difficult. So we've got the perfect solution for you. You should use what I use, and that is ShareFile by Citrix. ShareFile ensures that files of almost any size will go through successfully without any bounce backs at all. Keeps your files safe, secure, and under your control. Using ShareFile is easy. All you do to send a file is click Send a File. There's a little link in Outlook if you use the Outlook integration that is easily there, or you can use their web interface. And either way, all you do is click the link, add your file, and it puts a link in the email you're sending, and the person that receives it can get right to the file that you need. It's flexible. You can access your files from anywhere via laptop, tablet, and smartphone, and you can share that way too. And it's built for professionals. Plus, their customer support team over there at Citrix and ShareFile are always available. So any questions that you have about using the product, customizing the product, they're going to be there for you to make sure that you have the most seamless and professional experience possible. It's perfect for sending everything from legal files to confidential documents. I find myself using it for large media files because, of course, that's the thing that you're never guaranteed to get through in an email. If you take just, you know, a couple of minutes of video that you need to share in a work secure environment that you're not posting up to some social media site, you're going to find that as soon as you get over just a couple of minutes, it's going to be too long to really make it through secure with any kind of assurance that it's going to go through. Maybe you can send it, maybe they can't receive it. But if you use ShareFile, you know that it's going to be there secure and for just the person that you're sending it to. It has great fine-grained permission controls to make sure that your files get to exactly the person they are intended. So I want you to try it with this special offer. You sign up today and you'll receive a free 30-day trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TWIL. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in the promo code TWIL, T-W-I-L. We thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, folks, we're going to move from the courtroom to the Olympics. And we thank our intern, Franklin, for creating some fun new bumpers for the show, which you just saw one of them. Let's talk about the Olympics and the way that they have been discussed or have been impacted by the existence of social media. Now, I remember way back in the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002, those Winter Games were right after blogging had become available. And that's really the first I remember of athletes and others at the Olympic venue having a clash with the IOC and the various national Olympic committees about what they could put online and what they could not from the games. And of course, that has only gotten more intensified as time has gone on. And this year, the International Olympic Committee has actually gone to athletes and said, we'd like you to tweet. We'd like you to share your experiences here at the Olympics, but we have some very stringent rules about how you can do so. Some of the things they can't do is broadcast any video or photos from an Olympic venue. And of course, they're very concerned about making sure that the exclusive Olympic sponsors maintain their exclusivity and that the athletes who may have deals with other sponsors for themselves personally, who aren't sponsors of the Olympics, keep that out of their media, their social media coverage of the games. So that is starting to cause some waves. In particular, the U.S. track and field team, who will be center stage next week, we have Leo Manzano, who's been actively flouting the rules and actually tweeting some things about his Nike sponsorship. And then we have Don Harper, who has been protesting by posting such things as pictures of herself with IOC Rule 40 taped over her mouth, indicating that, you know, she's being tied down and not able to say the things that she would have otherwise said about the games. And the other complaint is that the individual athletes are being sort of shunted aside to make way for the corporate sponsors, and that the athletes need to be able to profit from the games too, or else they, you know, they, in an Ad Age article about all this, there was anecdotal discussion of athletes going to the games, participating, and then going back perhaps to live in a car because they're in such dire financial straits. So Nancy, as I read through all of this, you know, I'm sort of reminded of governments and how they would like to, in many instances, have better say and control over what their citizens do. This is sort of a microcosm, especially as it plays out in an international sort of pseudo-governmental environment with all the countries coming together to cooperate for the games. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's sort of a thing, turn of events in many respects. And of course, you know, as with many of these kinds of controls, they're bypassed, and there are a host of articles that find about the different and creative ways that the tech savvy athletes and other participants in the games are actually getting their views out. And you see that in other instances where, whether it's companies or countries or whatnot, try to exert a certain amount of control. Because the internet is essentially user-centric, because ultimately the power is with the individuals, they find a way to be heard. And, you know, now I think there are sites and there are a whole streams of discussion about how to bypass the controls that the Olympics and the sponsors have tried to exert. And it's, these things are rarely a lot of energy goes into sustaining them when maybe the energy could be used in a more productive way. But the Olympic coverage, it's been fascinating, and it is a fascinating way to see how people will get the information out or get access to the information that they want. And we've seen that play out over and over again in countries around the world.
Wait, but can you make the comparison between getting the information out and an athlete saying she's wearing Nike shoes? I mean, is that the same? Like, do we need the same? I mean, there's Arab Spring, and then there's corporate right. sponsorship. Are they the same?
Well, but don't you think, I mean, speech, who's to judge? I mean, is my speech more important than yours? I think the bottom line is that, you know, there are users, this is an athlete, I don't know, is a track star who's decided she has something to say. It's not up to me or to you to say that what she has to say is valuable or somehow less valuable because Nike's associated with it.
Yeah, she has something to say that has an inherent value to it, right? And that value, for better or worse, is the exclusive provenance of the IOC to unlock, right? To say the marketing associated with the Olympic Games has been sold to Coca-Cola and to not Pepsi, and we can't have our athletes undermining that exchange because they personally have sold it to Pepsi. It's just a condition of participation, I suppose. I mean, I think this is stupid. I mean, this is like the dumbest argument that the IOC can have with athletes possible. But they're the ones hosting the games. Do they not have the rules to say? Do they not have the authority to say you can't undermine our sponsorship relationships?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm saying they don't have the authority. I guess the question for the IOC is this really actually effective in the long run? Are they using a model that worked 10, 15 years ago when people, weren't carrying around their communications devices in their pockets. As with a lot of these things, you may have to step back and say, does this advertising model actually still work? It doesn't seem to be. It may be that they have to step back and say, maybe this isn't consistent with the modern communication age, and maybe they have to evolve. I'm not saying they don't have the authority. I guess I'm saying, is this time and energy well spent?
Right. You know, what's funny is that I think that maps on to the other kind of big story, which is Twitter having the journalist Guy Adams, his account pulled down for a couple of days because he was criticizing NBC and published the guy's email address. And it's like, well, Twitter, they enforce their terms of service. And they're allowed to do it. It's their terms of service. They can change it any way they want. But that was clearly a bad call, right? I mean, everything about their use of their terms of service, how they enforce it, and, whatever. It's a private service. They literally can do whatever they want in that service. But Twitter functions as a utility to most people. They don't see it as participating in a private service. They can do anything that they want. And it's almost as though they're held to a higher public standard of a utility or like a common carrier, as opposed to a private service that can manage its content, which is what they were doing, managing content in the service any way they want. And I think it's the same thing. The IOC has to realize that ultimately what it is a huge content generation engine, right? That's what the Olympics are. It's videos of people competing. It's, there's sport and honor and patriotism at the core of it. But ultimately, the value that they're generating is in the massive amount of content that they create in video and now in social media, all the other stuff they're doing. And they have to learn how to value and manage the social media content that all of its athletes are generating the same way they value and monetize the content that they're used to traditionally creating.
Yeah, I think it's a question of the rationality of those rules. I think that Twitter steps into that role of we are something more than just a private service. We understand that we have a free speech role in people's lives, and they time and time again take actions that, we applaud them for along those lines. I think here they made a misstep, particularly, I like their rule that underlies this, that says that you may not post private information about other individuals. But you get into trouble when you start trying to parse what's private. And here, I think, you know, someone's corporate email address that had been published on the web before, I would at least like to see, you know, of course, we would never hear about it, but some sort of internal policy at Twitter that would say, okay, so if we're going to pull down a journalist's critical post based on the fact that he published someone's email, we're at least at bare minimum going to do a Google search and see if we come up with that email out there, you know, in the wild on the web. Because, you know, now if you do that, of course, you're going to find it because of all the media coverage around
but
all
that's
this.
That's such a ridiculous loophole, right? I mean, it's if you want to put something private on Twitter, you just put it on your own Tumblr first. And now you can tweet it out to the world and it's in one Google result. I mean, it's a very legalistic argument that's being made. It's how public is public. Okay, well, let's do 50 years of appellate court decisions on how public something is on the internet before Twitter's terms of service kick in. I don't think anybody wants to go down that road, you know?
I don't think so. But, you know, I mean, I have often said I wouldn't want to be in Alex McGillivray's shoes because he has to make some, and he is general counsel and head of policy, and now they have a division called trust and something else, I'm not sure, that was at issue in this dispute. That, you know, he's got to make some really tough calls. And as I said, I like the concept of saying, you know, on our service, we're going to try and keep people's private information from being outed. But, you know, they also have the stance that they've taken, and I think it's a good one, that they are a journalistic tool. And if someone is doing journalism on Twitter and perhaps calling people to action is a form of that, then they've got to let it go. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to make the call. And Nilay, you're absolutely right. You know, there's making the Google search the touchstone might not be the best solution because it's such an easy workaround. But, you know, if it's out, what you're finding is not the email address in someone's separate Tumblr account, but in, you know, the speaker biography for something where, you know, people were supposed to get in touch with them at that address, then there's a difference. But how many thousands of employees do you need to police that kind of thing? Matt, we haven't heard from you. Do you have any thoughts on this?
No, I think it's been pretty well covered. I guess I just didn't find it to be that big a deal since it's not like he gave the guy's, you know, home address or something. It really didn't. It seemed ridiculous. And I don't know if they've seen my Twitter stream, but they need to filter that a little better.
Right, exactly.
I kid.
Well, Twitter's taken a lot of flack over this. There's a whole pound Twitter fail hashtag about it. If you want more information, in fact, we'll make that our first MCLE passphrase for the show, pound Twitter fail. Moving right along, we've been talking about how code is law in these kinds of situations, both for the Olympics making rules and private entities making rules. Of course, the greater laws in our land are made by governments, both nationally and internationally, and we're coming up on something on the policy front in December, I believe it is, called WICKET. And this is an acronym that Sally can share for us. WICKET stands for?
World Conference on International Telecommunications.
Great. And it's been getting an awful lot of press and an awful lot of concern because it is a private treaty body that is getting that will have a confab and make some decisions about various government policies that will have the form of international law that relate to the internet. So there's been a lot of concern about what might take place there. Why don't you, Sally, tell us who the U.S. representatives at this confab will be and whether they have any particular agenda going into it?
Sure. Just by way of background, the WICCET is an international treaty conference, as was said, and it is a revision to a 1988 treaty that was written for telecommunications. So the governments have decided that in light of the changes that have happened since 1988, they need to update this thing. The U.S. delegation will be led by a gentleman by the name of Ambassador Terry Kramer. He was just named by the White House for this role as special ambassador. And in fact, the U.S. government just released its national contribution to the WICCET today. So we have some sort of an understanding of where they're headed. One of the things that they have said very clearly, and a number of other governments have said, but not nearly enough, that the international telecommunications regulations and the technology is not the same as the internet, and the regulatory framework for telecommunications should not be applied to the internet. That is not a view that is shared by all 193 countries that will go to this conference. And it will be a significant point of discussion in Dubai in December as governments try to decide whether they're going to extend this treaty and all of the things that go with that to IP-based traffic.
Got it. Well, we've had some concern that the coverage of this has been a bit alarmist and that actually, the ITU does not want to step into the role of governing the internet or interfering with the way the internet operates. There's an op-ed in the New York Times about this. Sally, what's your response to that?
Well, first of all, this is a treaty. The ITU of the UN is simply the place that people are going to have this conversation. This is a treaty that's going to be decided by the member states and not by the UN secretariat or the ITU secretariat. So we're really in the hands of the governments themselves. And what they decide there is going to be treaty law. It's going to be obligations that they will then take home to their national governments and implement. It's been our view that in reading a number of the proposals, they would have considerable implications for the internet architecture, for the operational aspects of the internet, security-related things. They're moving, potentially some governments would like to move this treaty into content and maybe even content control. So, you know, everyone has their different terms of what is internet governance or whether this is a UN takeover. I think the more important thing is what will be the impact on the architecture itself, cross-border data flows, the ability for standards to be developed around the world, et cetera. And that's what we're looking at the most carefully. And there are a host of proposals that really would bring in the internet to this treaty.
And who will be there from the U.S.?
Well, the Ambassador Kramer will lead the U.S. delegation for the State Department, but they will have a host of people from both government and the private sector on the U.S. delegation to the conference.
And do you have any concern about the makeup of the people who will be going on behalf of the U.S. and making suggestions and responding to the other country's suggestions?
No, I think the U.S. is preparing for this. They've been preparing for this for a long time. They have the ambassador fully in place now. This is a major diplomatic undertaking, and it operates at the level of diplomacy, at the level of technology, commercial interests, civil society interests. So there's a lot that any delegation to this will have to balance, and the U.S. is going to have to do that with the rest of them. I think the U.S. statement today is fairly encouraging in terms of where they want to go. I think the biggest question is where do the other countries line up? And they're lining up in regional blocks right now. So we have the Asia-Pacific region and the Arab region. And they have a point of view, and they, in many cases, a very strong point of view about how broad this treaty should go.
Nilay, what do you think about all this? Are you worried about what might happen in December?
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is, that, you know, this idea that that paperwork done by diplomats will affect how people use the internet, you know? Mm-hmm. And I worry about it. You know, this ultimately comes down to how each of these countries decides to implement their own networks, and how, in many cases, you know, in the United States, like, we have a lot of private companies that own the internet, right? And they are doing stuff regardless of what the government is deciding to do, and regardless of what the ITU and the UN decide to do. And that's ultimately, you know, the thing I think about the internet is I can't remember who the quote is from, but the internet is a tool that, you know, it treats censorship as damage and it routes around it. And I wonder if, you know, if the ITU passes this treaty or some treaty that is bad and gives Russia tacit approval to censor the internet, will it be able to respond to it? I mean, is this, I guess that's my biggest question. This is only important if this treaty gives Russia the ability to affect that core structure of the internet, that core principle of the internet, that it will just figure a way out around censorship. Is that really a danger here? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The internet will route around some of this. One of the biggest concerns that we have is that a lot of these proposals, you know, they go to regulating those private commercial arrangements that you were just talking mm-hmm. about, peering relationships, transit relationships, et cetera, to an extent that developing countries may find themselves really on the losing side of that conversation, where costs are going to go up for internet users. And the value then goes down for people around the world who expect the internet to be, in fact, global. So the question really is, as a result of this, do we end up with a certain level of fragmentation? Do we end up with, for example, I'm here at the IETF meeting, a group that develops internet protocols, that many of which we're using right now. What's going to be the impact on their ability to develop standards that are deployed globally? These are all areas that the treaty proposals have tried to address. And, you know, I think at a minimum, what you could see is a tremendous amount of legal and commercial uncertainty if we don't get this right.
It seems to me that we were talking about the Olympics, and it provides a nice microcosm for what we might see happen when governments like China and the Arab states begin to try and make their views known on an international kind of an arena and get other countries perhaps to buy into them having tighter controls. You know, we could have seen the IOC crack down, not just, you know, in a rules-making way on the athletes, but in an access way, you know, that they might be able to regulate things before they go out. They might be able to pull things down themselves rather than relying on Twitter to be able to do it. Matt, do you see a danger in governments implementing those kinds of controls?
Governments, certainly. I mean, I think there's a difference between the corporations we're talking about or even the Olympic entities. Mm-hmm. Other than that, no, I think it's I like what's been said so far. I will not, I'm not too proud to say that this is completely outside my wheelhouse mm-hmm. and that I, you know, I have a lot of gut reactions to things like this, but not a lot of insight into the law. So, but, you know, I'll leave it with that. That's what I like to say.
Well, maybe, you know, just to give a practical example of one of mm-hmm. the proposals, there's a proposal that says that governments shall have the right to know how traffic is being routed in and out of their countries and the right to regulate how that traffic is being routed for purposes of preventing fraud and addressing security. Mm-hmm. So what you've done there is you've taken, you know, the essentially the best effort internet where traffic is moved across the world at, you know, tremendous speed through all sorts of commercial arrangements that are not nation state driven, right? The traffic doesn't come with a country code per se attached to it. And now we move into a space where governments are going to decide the routes for IP traffic, which is a fundamental architectural issue, operational issue, commercial issue. And in one sentence, you bring all of that. You at least raise the question as a legal matter about how that would be done and what it would mean for countries.
I mean, to me, that sounds like SOPA writ large, right? I mean, that's in this country, that's what that was. That was saying, we're going to start monkeying with DNS. I think it was Ars Technica called it Fortress America. SOPA is trying to build Fortress America around the American internet to keep out the bad actors in Eastern Europe or something. And that, to me, just sounds like allowing for that kind of writ large. But the question is, you know, Russia could do that today. My fundamental question is, why are they trying to do this at the ITU scale when all these member states can just do it today? I mean, America was about to enact SOPA all by itself. It didn't need the ITU or the UN. Why is this happening in that body?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think in some cases, they may actually want some technical assistance in doing this. I think they also want the international legitimacy, if they can point to this and say, look, we're doing this pursuant to a treaty. You know, don't tell us we're bad. We're, you know, the UN says it's the right thing to do. I think all of those things factor into it. You know, maybe in some cases we see that there are proposals where countries or individual companies are trying to accomplish something in the UN that they couldn't accomplish at home to get the legitimacy there and take it back home with them. So there are a lot of agendas, as you can imagine, 193 countries all coming with their own regional issues, domestic challenges, geographic issues. You know, small island developing states have a different set of challenges than, you know, a large developing country might have that's landlocked, or you know, the challenges in Europe and all of the issues around access charges in Europe are playing out in this treaty. So it's very layered, it's very complex, but in the end, you know, it's our expectation that a treaty will emerge from this conference. And the internet community and internet users and companies will all have to figure out then what we do with it.
Do you think it's going to lead to more, you know, I think the Olympics is another really interesting situation where, you know, my readers in the United States, you know, they weren't interested in IP spoofing and UK VPNs until this week, when they're hugely interested in IP spoofing and pretending that their computer is in the UK to get access to the BBC coverage. Will this have kind of an impact on that? I mean, right now what I see is the internet is a series of like isolated little country-by-country fiefdoms almost. Do you think this is going to have an is it going to make it more? Is it going to build higher barriers? Is it going to make a series of increasingly disconnected internal internets in every country? Or do you think it'll actually make it more connected because, the you know, if the countries have a treaty structure in place, that they'll feel more comfortable kind of increasing the connections?
Well, I mean, the latter is what the original treaty was intended to do for telecommunications networks. So, right. You know, you think about 1988, you think government monopolies. They wanted some rules to exchange traffic across borders and also, frankly, to exchange money for the termination of traffic. So they felt like they needed a treaty that would, you know, help, you know, lay the ground rules for telecommunications traffic on an international level. So, you know, there is some possibility, I suppose, that this treaty could lead to that. If it doesn't do the former. And of course, I mean, I think the thing that we're the most concerned about is, yeah, you end up with this kind of fragmentation where, you know, it simply becomes too expensive to interconnect with certain regions or certain countries. The standards don't promote global interoperability anymore. They're based on political decisions rather than market conditions. So, you know, there's a host of different types of outcomes that are possible. But, you know, if countries decide they want to go in a different direction and say, you know, we're going to look at the things that have actually made telecommunications successful on a global scale since 1988, then you could get a treaty that looks like what you were, you know, the second option. I think our biggest concern is that we're headed towards the first.
Yeah. I mean, that the first, I mean, that undoes the promise of the internet, right? If we, right. we build Absolutely. Fortress America. But so here's my follow-up question, because I followed SOPA very closely, and we're still covering it very closely. How do you solve the problem of counterfeit Eastern European goods being sold to unsuspecting American housewives in the heartland without blocking the server? I mean, that's the problem, right? I mean, if you ask, I asked Al Franken, why did you do this? And he said, that's why. How do you solve that problem?
Well, I think you're not going to solve it by re-architecting the internet, or in this case, the domain name system. As we've seen, and a lot of people talked about in SOPA, there were certainly there are going to be a host of consequences that flow from that, none of which were very desirable, either on a legal level or on a technical level. So that doesn't work. I think what does work is a level of international cooperation, even particularly at the technical level and with law enforcement, to figure out how you address this in a way that doesn't have those broader technical implications, that doesn't break DNSSEC, that doesn't result in, you know, a complete lack of due process. And I don't know that anybody's come up with a perfect answer to that question. But SOPA and PIPA was, you know, as obviously as it turned out, and people finally realized, it simply wasn't going to solve the problem. It was going to be a temporary measure that would have, you know, huge unintended consequences.
No, I agree. I mean, my company came out against it very publicly. But the problem is actually kind of a huge problem. And
I
feel like the internet community they know not to click the bad links in email, but most other people don't. And I think solving that problem is actually kind of critical, but you have to do it in a considered and reasonable way. And to me, that's, if the ITU wants to sell whatever bill or whatever treaty they're going to produce, that's how they're going to sell it. And they're going to say the solution to that problem. And maybe you're talking about these economic concerns underneath it. It's a solution to that problem. How do we arrange payment for traffic? And that to me, that's the cloud of, won't anyone think of the children? And suddenly we can't have a real conversation. And I feel like you need to have an alternative solution to the problem to present, right, to say you don't have to monkey with the architecture of the internet because here's a better solution. That's the challenge to me.
Yeah, I mean, none of these, you know, these issues don't have always easy, quick fix solutions. You know, putting three lines in the treaty isn't going to bring down internet connectivity costs worldwide. But the reality is, and at ISOC, we've seen a lot of this and been involved in this since, you know, very early days of the internet. You know, regions have had to overcome high interconnection costs since the beginning. There was a time, and in some cases it still exists, but there was a time in Asia where, you know, all the traffic was being pushed to the U.S. and then back, and it was, you know, hugely expensive. They developed the local infrastructure, and they developed some of the policy and legal framework to keep traffic local, to keep content local, and that has had a huge impact. Europe had the same issue, getting, you know, traffic costs between Paris and Berlin were incredibly high until they built that cross-border legal framework that they needed that allowed for traffic to move between those countries and not across to the U.S. and back. So these are hard decisions. They take an incredible amount of time, you know, and I think maybe the thing that we all have to do is say, you know, we're all here and willing to do that hard work, but it isn't going to be solved, like I said, with three lines in a treaty.
So one of the things that Eric Fanner in the New York Times writes of is whether the forthcoming treaty might be more about opening up the way that you can charge for traffic on the internet, that maybe this is more about net neutrality than it is about internet governance. Do you have a thought on that?
You know, this is again where I said you have a lot of agendas playing out on a lot of different levels. So, you know, the net neutrality debate, I think that's quite true, particularly between within the European countries. Not as much of the focus, for example, coming from Africa. You have different, you know, motivating forces from different regions, and, you know, which is not surprising. But I think it's a little tough to generalize and say the, you know, the whole thing is about net neutrality. But there are definitely threads of that that come into this discussion.
There's also kind of a parallel to ACTA, which we saw unfold and then fall apart for so long, in that what the various countries' agendas and proposals are has not been terribly transparent. There's a leaks site that has been tracking and getting out information. Do you see any improvement in that situation as we come toward the meeting in December, or is it still going to be kind of all a mystery until it transpires?
Well, I think the ITU itself as an organization is a membership organization. So countries are members, and then they have sector members or corporate members. And those folks have access to the documents, but they pay for that access. And so the rest of the world is not permitted to see what's being proposed. And that lack of transparency has really, I think, been noticed. And it's been noticed, as you said, by many of the same people who were upset about ACTA and upset about the fact that you had governments behind closed doors negotiating something that was going to affect everyone. And this process is suffering from a little bit of that, well, quite a bit of that same frustration from civil society and others who don't have access. We're starting to see some impact of that pressure, and the ITU has asked its membership if they can release some of the documents. Unfortunately, the member states have said no. But so now I think the real call has to be for member states themselves at the national level to release the documents to their constituents. And it's up to the internet community and you know, stakeholders and users around the world to say, you know, to their governments, I want to know what you're saying on my behalf. Where do I show up? How do I have a voice? I want to know about this before you go to Dubai. And that's going to be the critical pressure point over the next couple of months before everyone gets on a plane and it's too late.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. And thank you for shedding so much light with us here today, Sally. We're going to switch gears a bit and talk a bit about privacy.
That and was awesome.
Yes, thank you again, Franklin.
That was amazing.
And in particular, we're going to talk about Google Fiber, which everyone seems to be very excited about. I know I would be excited if I were able to access this high-speed broadband service in my particular neck of the woods. It seems like it's going to be quite a bit of time before everyone is going to be able to kick the tires on the service. You guys at The Verge have been following this very closely, but one thing I haven't seen you guys write about yet, and you can point us to any articles I might have missed, is the notion that Google, you know, already knows so much about us, and now they're going to, you know, once they become people's ISP and their deliverer, not just of internet access, but also conventional television programming, that situation gets even more compounded. Nilay, are you concerned about this at all?
I guess I would be if Google Fiber was anything more than like what billionaires get to do because they can. Do you know what I mean? Everything about Google Fiber to me suggests that it's Google's experimenting. You know, they're going to see what happens to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. It's like a mad scientist project, right? Like, let's dump 1,000 megabit broadband in Kansas City and see if the citizens tear each other apart. You know, like it's that kind of experiment for Google. I think it's really valuable that they do it. I think they're going to basically prove that broadband enhances an economy, right? That if you connect an entire city at really fast speeds, citizens will do great things with it. They will find a way to increase, you know, their own creativity. They'll find a way to create new goods. They will provide new services to each other. That's really interesting. I think if Google makes it a business, then the pressure of how do we make this an effective business and another profit center for our company, it's like Google knows one way to make money, right? And it's to take your personal information and sell ads against it. And so then it's a problem, right? Then it's, well, now we have to tell Google to not do that with the internet as a mm-hmm. whole, instead of just a suite of Google services.
Maybe Google fixes television advertising this way. You know, they've certainly made the contextual ads in search a lot more palatable than they used to be. I mean, there was no such thing as a contextual ad in search.
Well, but do you want that to be the case? Do you want Google to this to me is the moment at which we start to ask ourselves, should the telecom companies also be the content companies? And should their business models align this tightly? So yeah, maybe it's great if Google can fix television advertising this way, but you might as well ask, why doesn't Comcast do it? Because Comcast owns NBC already, and they already own the pipes. Google building a faster network in one city doesn't give them any more sort of ability to solve that problem than Comcast owning most of the network in the United States and already owning NBC. And it's the same problem. You know, one of the most interesting things to me about Google Fiber is that ultimately what the product is isn't very novel. It's not very unique. It's just really fast. You know, the television package and the way the television service works is very iterative. I mean, it's the same product you buy from Comcast. It's just a nicer DVR. And they're putting it directly over the IP lines because the broadband is so fast. But, like, they didn't really do anything there that Comcast couldn't do if they had really fast lines and the ability to produce a good DVR, which I'm not saying Comcast does. They make really crappy DVRs. But the potential for Comcast to do the exact same thing with NBC in its pocket already is there. And it's only because the government has regulated away as a condition of the merger, the government said you can't do a bunch of stuff, that I think Comcast is treading very lightly with NBC. But that's why they bought NBC. That's what I'm saying. So to me, Google, the thing about Google Fiber to me that suggests it was designed by billionaires for billionaires is that every cable box that you attach to every TV is also a Wi-Fi access point. And that to me is like the funniest thing in the world, because it's who has that problem that they need to put Wi-Fi access points at every TV in their home, except people who live in mansions in California. You know, like it's such a, the whole product is it's so well conceived for like one situation. But I don't know that Google can take it everywhere. And if they do, then I think they're going to run into the exact same questions that we already have with Comcast and NBC.
Well, is it a Wi-Fi repeater, or could be your only Wi-Fi access point, right? So you just
It could be your only, but it's a, you know, their whole thing is that you record 8 shows at once on this 2 terabyte box called the storage box, and that streams to every TV, and then every TV in your home is an access point. It's not a router; it's an access point. But it's like most people right now have one router in their home, and it's just funny. It's like you can say, like Sergey Brin was like, you know, I just can't get a good signal on the corner of my 20,000-foot estate. Put a Wi-Fi access point there. You know, like how do we solve this problem? While we put Google, you know, it's just one of those things. It's just funny to me.
It's either jumping out of a blimp or
exactly. you know, but it just to me the questions are there. The Comcast NBC tech media infrastructure questions exist with Google Fiber, but because of what it is and how it's being deployed in Kansas City, I think the more interesting questions are all, okay, here's this thing. Here's this awesome thing. Here's this incredible broadband. What are you going to do with it? How is this going to change the city? And the when Google makes it a big business, then I think those questions, the other questions about privacy and how they deploy media will come into play in a much more prominent way.
Matt, you want to chime in?
No, I'm in learning mode right now.
is your connection too slow and you're just waiting for fiber?
Yeah, I can't get anything out here, so it doesn't matter.
That's right.
If I could, I would. It's cheap right? It's not that. Yeah, it's relatively inexpensive.
It's $70 a month for just the broadband and $1.20 for the broadband and TV. But you don't get they don't have deals with Disney yet, so you don't get ESPN.
Right, or HBO. That's a big.
Yeah,
locker.
I mean, they'll get there. I think that's just a matter of hammering. I mean, because again, the cable system that they're implementing is exactly the same, and the deals are the same. You know, if Google wanted to revolutionize cable TV, they would sell you a la carte TV channels, and they're not. They're selling the same bundles as Time Warner or anybody else.
Yeah, good point. Sally, any trepidation on your part when you think of a content provider also being your ISP and, by the way, knowing all of your online web activity on your various other devices?
Yeah, there's an enormous capacity for them to put together a fascinating picture, I guess, that I'd like to know about myself, but I probably mm-hmm. don't. But on the other hand, you know, it's, you know, with this kind of accumulation is going to come a huge level of responsibility and also a lot of scrutiny. And I was just thinking as I was listening, I'm learning about this as you're talking about it, but I was just thinking at what point does Google run up against yet another set of regulatory structures that either put limitations on this or at a minimum change what, you know, the business plan that they have in mind. I'm not sure that you can pretend to be a TV network and not be subject to some of the community provisions that come with that. It'd be interesting to see.
All righty then, let's move next to the social web. And thanks again, Franklin, for our new little bumpers. We love them. This has to do with YouTube and the fact that, well, it depends whether you read the YouTube blog or some of the other coverage of this. It has not rolled out to me personally as a user, but over on YouTube, you are being given the ability, according to YouTube, to, if you've been using a pseudonym on that service since its inception, change that over to the real name that you're using in connection with your Google Plus account. And of course, Google has taken tons of flack about its real names policy on Google Plus and its implementation. But in reading the YouTube blog post about this, it seems that they are doing it in the right way, that they, you know, if you'd like to use your real name, you may do so. And in addition, they're going to let you go through and look at all your past uploads and say, okay, that one I'd really rather have a pseudonym associated with. And this one I'd like associated with my real name online identity. Over on TechCrunch, they have a good piece about how over in Korea, there's good evidence that requiring people to use their real names in online discussions really doesn't add significantly to the civility or caliber of the discussion. It's something that is such a common question these days or a conundrum that it's popping up even on HBO's The Newsroom show, where they clamped down on their fictional comment policy on the show. But because people can route around most such controls, an anonymous commenter was able to make a death threat against their Anchorman main character, Jeff Daniels. So we've got this happening over at YouTube. Once again, it hasn't rolled out to my account, so I'm not quite sure, you know, how the implementation will work. Neelai, what do you think of this?
I mean, YouTube, anything YouTube does to try and tame their cesspool of a comment system mm-hmm. is good. I mean, YouTube comments are, I think they're the archetype for crappy comments on the web, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. here's a picture of a baby and someone says something racist about the baby, like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So anything they do is better. I mean, I'm looking at this TechCrunch story about the policy in Korea, and it's hard to know how that actually worked or how it played out. And mm-hmm. The number is kind of hilarious. The policy reduced unwanted comments by an estimated 0.09%. It's like, how did you measure that? Like, what? Like, did you, who, what? Like, I'm so confused by that statement. You know, I have no doubt that South Korea enacted this policy and took it down after it wasn't effective, but it's just that line to me jumps out. I mean, we run a huge community at The Verge.
Right.
And some people use their real names. You know, I use my real name on The Verge. Some people don't. And to me, the thing that keeps our community clean, and it's funny that one of the main ways we keep our community clean is that our community talks a lot about policing itself and about being clean and whether the comments are going downhill and at what point at what point will there be too many members of the community for it to effectively police itself? And they talk about, it's funny, people on The Verge talk about it all the time. It's, there are endless threads. We have a metaphor on The Verge. We just talk about The Verge. And there are endless threads in the metaphor about whether comments are going downhill and whether it's inevitable that comments will go downhill as the user base of The Verge increases. And it's kind of like, well, that's the thing that saves it. It's the culture of the community that says we're worried about this that saves it. And whether or not you have real names or you have fake names or you mandate real names or you say you can do whatever you want, if you don't have that culture, it doesn't matter. Because the internet, you can use your real name on the internet. It's still pretty much anonymous. And you're still, you know, you're still a kid in Kansas talking to it. Somebody else in Washington, and you can still say whatever you want. It's really never going to come back to you, especially on Google Plus, because nobody uses Google Plus, right?
Except for the millions and millions of people who do.
Right. Well, it was a joke.
Neely doesn't. He's only got like one post on there, I think.
Yeah, I just can't. I have too many Google accounts. I just can't like log into Google Plus the way I want to. Otherwise, I would. But I think that's the key, is what YouTube has to do is start to build a culture of commenters who are valuable. And YouTube is so big, it's so massive, and the community there is so massive that it's hard. It's going to be hard for them. And so one little step to say, let's start down this road of building a culture that works, I think is good. I mean, I don't think real names are the solution. I think it's a part of a bigger solution.
Well, yeah, I guess my question would be, I know that TechCrunch a while back implemented their Facebook comments right. for that reason. Mm-hmm. Has there been any kind of conclusion of whether or not that's helped at all? Kind of the real name.
They don't say so
issue?
in their article on the topic, but I'm sure they would. Yeah. They would.
Trolls are trolls. I would
bet, and I know that millions of people do use Google Plus, but I would bet if YouTube said you have to comment using your Facebook page so that your community can see this on Facebook, and they will self, like, you leave a comment on a YouTube video and like your dad can see it because it's on Facebook, that would change everything really fast, because that's the, Facebook has a community of limited reach for people, right? It's the people you theoretically, you know, and they are watching what you do. And so, you know, Facebook has its own problems too, but I don't see a lot of trolling on Facebook, right? Because the community regulates itself because it's inherently small. If they can get Google Plus to Facebook, where you do have that community and that level of interest and activity in your circles, basically, that might have a huge effect on YouTube.
But so what you're saying is you got to bring your mom in or your dad. If they're your friends in there and they actually see what the crap you're saying.
Right, exactly. You're policed by the people you're policed by the people you actually care about, instead of being policed by an anonymous army of millions. Maybe it'll help. I don't know the answer. I'm just spitballing. Yeah.
Technically,
isn't
there
a role for anonymity in this space?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I mean, isn't there a legitimate role for anonymity in this space? I mean, it's one thing to be commenting on silly cat videos, but another when you're talking about, you know, some more serious issues, whether it's diversity or things where people may not wish to identify themselves. And wouldn't we lose that dialogue as a result?
I don't think so. I mean, that's the thing, you know, I don't think you can look at YouTube comments and make a sane argument, a reasoned argument for losing the dialogue, because it's a cesspool. And it is truly a cesspool. If you want to make an anonymous statement about some policy issue, or you want to be a whistleblower, and you choose YouTube comments, you have made an egregious mistake in messaging, right?
Yeah.
There is a place for anonymity, and I there's a lot of places to be anonymous on the web, but YouTube comments are a place where there's mostly hate and there's mostly bile and there's overt sexism in a terrible way, and that to me is if what we lose, if the exchange is we're going to lose this place is safe for anonymity, and we're going to gain out of it the removal of all of this, I mean, shit, just the worst kind of shit, I'm okay with it personally. I mean, I take your point, but it's so bad, so particularly bad on YouTube, that it's hard to make that argument it's hard to hear the argument.
I think there might be a different experience, you know, if the Internet Society has a channel on YouTube as opposed to ICANN has Cheeseburger. You know, that the comments for those two ecosystems are going to be different. So,
but you know, we have a channel on YouTube and we we publish our video and we spend a lot of money in our video and we, you know, I like to think that we produce pretty high end content, and our YouTube comments are distinctly lower caliber than the comments on our own site. And I can't tell you why that is. I just know that it's true.
So this kind of jibes with what we were talking about a moment ago with Google Fiber and the more Google knows about us. Google took some flack a couple of months ago when it redid its privacy policy to cover, have a unified policy across its various services. And now this just seems to be another arm of that beast that, you know, we want, you have a real name identity on Google Plus if you are using it, and why not just use it across our various properties? Sally, does that give you any pause?
Sorry, I'm really not the privacy expert on at ISOC, but I do think I think it's probably better if I don't opine, if I don't know exactly what I'm talking about.
Sure. Or if you do, just, you know, drop it in an anonymous YouTube comment
to the
show, and we'll get your thoughts there.
Yeah.
All right then.
The file. I like that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. File for all. We'll go ahead and make real names our second MCLE passphrase for the show. And if you are interested in getting continuing legal education or other kinds of
I can get CLEs, yes, for this.
You can.
This changes everything. Can I be on the show every week?
Yeah, you can just watch it.
If you go over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv and go to the Twill page, we have a whole lot of information about the various states and how you can get legal education credit. And lots of other professionals have been writing in since we started doing this and saying, well, we have education, professional education requirements that we think Twill will apply to too. So lots of folks are taking advantage of this, and we're really glad about that. We're going through the process of becoming an accredited provider in California right now, and we're going to try and roll through all the states, which is a long and complex endeavor that we never could have tackled without the help of our intern Franklin this summer. So we're really grateful to him. And right now what you've got there is a page with the requirements for all the various states. And what you're left with at the moment is you can, if you want to try and get credit, there are links to all the forms and applications for the various states, and you can mail in your own request right now. We hope to be able to make it even easier for you in the future. So that's why we're dropping these passphrases into the show, because some states require that you, if you're watching a show like this and you want to have credit, that you have some way of proving that you actually watched. So that's our little workaround for that.
Are you putting them in the show notes, the passphrase?
No, because that would make it too easy, wouldn't it?
Well, that's the point. I know.
Denise, can you send me the passphrase every week?
Yeah.
Now we want to be legitimate about our MCLE chops here. All right, Sally, I just want to close with you. I know there are a couple of other items coming up that could be of concern that we didn't really touch on in the Wicket process. One has to do with taxation and the other has to do with internet connection. Can you quickly bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. I think it's actually some of what we talked about earlier, but there are a couple proposals that have come forward from the European operators that have asked that we re-architect things so that we have a system of sending party network pays, essentially trying to get it over the top providers and find a way to ensure that commercial arrangements protect the revenues of existing operators. And this is a proposal that's come forward and to be put in the treaty. And that's just another example of the ways in which they're looking to embed within the treaty things that benefit either particular countries, companies, regions, and really don't scale on a global basis. Those sorts of proposals are public, and we've been writing about them, and you can get more information about that on our website.
Great. Thanks so much. All right, we're going to go to our tip of the week, which this week is, if you are one of these people who has been asked by their employer to fork over, say, your Facebook password or any other social media password so that they can further delve into your background and decide whether or not to employ you, you can take heart and don't tell them. And if you're an employer, don't ask, because the real trend here legislatively in the United States is that this is going to be a no-no. We've got Illinois enacting a law this week that employer requests such as that are going to be illegal in Illinois. Maryland has done so already. California is considering one. So definitely that is starting to be something that legislators are paying attention to. And don't ask, don't tell should be, I think, the policy for social media passwords, and seems to be where this is headed. So if you are put in that situation, bear that in mind, or tell your employer, hey, you know, lots of states are starting to say this is not a good idea. Also, we've got a couple of resources for you this week. One of them is, jibes very well with something we were discussing about all the information that is being gathered about us and who knows what and whether you know any of it. There's a TED Talk, with a gentleman named Malte Spitz, if I'm not butchering his name too badly. He is a German fellow, and he went to his mobile phone company and got a whole bunch of data from them that represented basically 6 months of his life on his mobile phone. Whole bunch of code that basically said where he was, when he was awake, when he was asleep, just to get an idea of what your mobile phone company knows about you. So it's a really interesting talk. I encourage you to check it out. And it's over at the TED Talks. That came to us from Jared Reimer. Thanks so much, Jared, for sending that in. And then also, we want you guys to check out, because it is a great podcast that you will love if you love ours. And that is The Verge's new show that is hosted by Josh Topolsky with Nilay Patel and Paul Miller. And in fact, on the current show, there's a great interview with Nilay and Al Franken, which we'd love to just play you a clip of so you can get an idea how that goes.
One second.
Okay. Thanks, Colin. That was a great piece, Nilay.
Oh, thanks. It was pretty wild to go up there and you know, I think a highlight of my career is asking a United States senator, what the hell were you thinking?
It's corporations are able to get all this information. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a little different than what most people thought of privacy law.
Right.
Because most people always thought of privacy law as the government, mm-hmm. you know, finding out what you're reading, or the government finding out.
Big brother.
Big brother.
Yeah.
This is now corporate big brother. And people don't. I think people have a fundamental right to privacy, and they have a fundamental right to know what, at least what's being taken mm-hmm. and being stored and control over it, whether it goes to third parties, and they don't.
So that was great. You got to have a nice long chat about SOPA and PIPA with the good Senator Nilay, and it was fascinating stuff. The name of the show is On the Verge, and I love the fact, too, Nilay, that when you go to all your bios on the page, it tells you how long you've been on the verge. I think in your case, they may have had to backdate from the actual launch of the site for that one. But so this episode has a game, not Yahoo Jeopardy. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, it's Jeopardy is what we called it.
Jeopardy.
Skirt around trademark issues. Yeah, we Yahoo Answers is hilarious. Another charming internet community of useful information. And we did Jeopardy with Yahoo Answers. So we read read the answers to Yahoo Answers questions, and then the Jeopardy answers were what the questions were, and they're all bonkers. It's pretty fun. It was a good time. I will say that putting on Jeopardy, much more of a technical challenge than you would imagine. We our guys backstage were making the Jeopardy board go. They built this incredible hack of a system. It's pretty hilarious.
That's wonderful. Also on there, this particular episode has Mary Jo Foley, who we love here at TWIT, of course, as well. So do go over and check that one out. Great job by you guys over at The Verge. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. We hope you've enjoyed. You know, we do record this show live every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So you can join us as we do that. Or if you'd like to pick up the show after the fact, we're on iTunes and YouTube and all of the various ways that you might like to consume your web television programming. We're going to be there for you. Of course, we have our own site, twit.tv/twill, with the whole archive of the shows. There's a Facebook page that you can jump on with us and talk about topics and guests as they're coming up. Same thing over on Google+. And you can reach me, of course, anytime. I'm Denise at twit.tv. That would be a public email address. No one will get in trouble for sharing that or emailing me there. Love to hear from you with your ideas about the show and topics and guests as well. So thanks so much, guys, for joining us. Sally, it's been a great pleasure meeting you. Keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot. It's great to chat with you all.
And Nilay Patel, thanks so much for joining us again.
Yeah, it's always great to be on. Sally, it was really nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
And Matt, thanks so much for helping us navigate the complex waters of the U.S. patent system. You're always so great at that for us, and we really appreciate it. Except that you're muted at this second, and we can't hear a word you're saying.
Sorry about that. I was typing earlier. I was trying to be polite. I love coming on here. I just wish, you know, it makes me realize I need to expand a little bit my horizons, my legal horizons. I get a little lazy at The Verge because Nilay is kind of the, he's the legal renaissance man. So he handles so many more things than I kind of stay focused on patent law. So,
well, someone's got to, and we appreciate you doing it.
Yeah, no, it's a blast. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time on This Week in Law.